Good morning. Mr. Ryder?
Good morning, Your Honors. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve a minute of my time for rebuttal. By FERC's own account, both congestion charges and marginal losses provide the same benefit to the marketplace. They provide certainty of pricing, they provide more accurate pricing, and presumably a more efficient outcome. But these charges also provide detriments to the marketplace. The risks they impose create uncertainty for parties engaged in the purchase and the securing of long-term supplies of electricity. The Commission fixed the problem with respect to congestion charges that ordered a hedge, but with respect to marginal losses, the Commission allowed the marginal loss charges to go into effect even though it had no solution to the problem, and even though SMUD had provided evidence to the Commission that the risk to long-term contracting associated with marginal losses was greater than the risk posed by congestion charges. The Commission's order, the entirety of its explanation for rejecting SMUD's position, and it's really not an explanation, it's just a conclusion, is encapsulated in the rehearing order at paragraph 42 of the order on rehearing of the MRTU initial order. And there they say, well, we can't fix marginal losses. We don't know a way to hedge them. And it says, we can't fix all risks anyway, but the benefits, the benefits outweigh the risks to the marketplace. But they can't reach that conclusion without having at least conducted an analysis of the contention SMUD made. They don't say whether they agree or disagree with SMUD's contention that that the risks were greater than the risks of congestion charges.
But and if I can ask, if in fact it's not possible to fix the hedge problem with marginal losses, doesn't that in itself make it different from the congestion?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think implicit in the Commission's approval of the mechanism, they said there has to be a hedge for congestion charges, and it's possible to do a fix, but under their theory, both congestion charges and marginal losses provide the same benefit. They say so. So implicit in the conclusion that a fix was needed for congestion charges is the assumption that the benefits of congestion pricing don't outweigh the risks to the marketplace to long-term contracting. So if, in fact, that's true, whether a fix or not was possible, there had to be some kind of a solution. And the solution, if you can't fix the problem, is to not allow marginal losses. Implicit, it seems to me, in the
Then, as Judge Brown says, an attack on the whole methodology of marginal losses, right?
Well, in effect,
which is your ultimate position, I suppose.
Yes, in effect, it is, Your Honor. If they can't provide a fix for it, and the problems that they create for the marketplace exceed the benefits of marginal loss pricing, then it's better not to do it. The Commission didn't grapple with that question at all.
On that question, of course, the Commission standard is whether it's just and reasonable, and our review of that determination has an extra level of deference packed into it, whether it was reasonable for the Commission to determine.
Yes, Your Honor, but even under the most deferential standard of review, this Court has said many times over that the agency is required to give consideration and grapple with the contentions of the parties. Here we presented evidence. The Commission doesn't say whether it agrees or disagrees with that contention. We also offered an alternative to the Commission. We said, well, in the MISO case, where customers were faced with a marginal loss charge for the first time, they gave them a transition period during which time the customers would be given a refund of the difference between the marginal loss charges and the average charges they would otherwise have paid. The Commission doesn't address that question at all in its orders. It doesn't say whether this case is distinguishable from that one, and if so, why. On brief, counsel offers a post hoc explanation that the Commission in the MISO case wanted experience with marginal losses and therefore ordered the transition period, and that it now has that experience and there's no need for a transition period any longer. But that's not what the MISO order says. And even if this court were permitted to rely on the post hoc rationale of counsel, The MISO order simply said, we're giving a transition period, as this court recognized in review of the MISO case, to afford the customers some protection.
Didn't the commission here say, one, marginal loss hedges are not required? We've said that before, Order 681. Two, there are other ways for you to take account of the problem.
They did say that marginal losses weren't required under Order 681, and that question, in fact, is on review and it's in abeyance here. We've raised that question. We've argued both that the absence of a marginal loss hedge or allowing marginal losses to go forward without a hedge violates both Order 890 and 681. But with respect to 681, that case would come before this court. I assume whatever the outcome in this case, it'll be mooted by the decision here. As for the ability to provide other means to ameliorate the problem, I think we've already pointed out to the commission that the commission itself says you can't hedge. I don't think the commission has offered any real solution to the problem other than to say, well, deal with it. Again, I think the commission's errors here are twofold. They failed to grapple with the questions that we presented on the risks posed to the marketplace from marginal losses, and that failure is arbitrary and capricious. And they departed without any explanation from the agency's own decision in the MISO case, at least granting a transition period during which marginal loss charges would be, the difference between marginal loss charges and average losses would be refunded to customers.
Now, in the green brief, the interveners suggest that they're not sure even what you mean by a marginal loss hedge, and that your argument assumes that an average losses method is somehow a standard or baseline measurement for transmission losses. You want to respond to that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the interveners point to the pro forma tariff, and if you look at the pro forma tariff, there's a space to plug in a loss. The only logical interpretation of the loss mechanism is that everybody pays under a pro forma tariff, as everyone pays the same charge. That has to be averaged by definition. If you look at the commission's order at paragraph 247 of the of its CRR order, and this is in volume 4 at joint appendix 3139, the commission effectively acknowledges that that's the status quo. I would also point out that in a case, Niagara, now this isn't in the briefs, but Niagara Power Corporation, 92 FERC, paragraph 61, 168.
So let me just understand that. You're saying average losses is the status quo.
Yes.
And so any departure from that is impermissible?
Well, no, not that it's, well, it would be impermissible if it doesn't meet the standard of providing service that's as good as or better than you'd get under the standard Order 890 tariff.
And ultimately, your position is that a marginal losses methodology won't be able to do that?
Not unless they can fashion a hedge. The commission, and we remain hopeful that that can happen. The commission doesn't say it's impossible. They say it may, it just hasn't been devised yet. And they encouraged the ISO encouraged several ISOs to continue to work on it. We're hopeful that'll happen at some point. But right now, we don't think the commission's provided a basis to implement marginal losses.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Beth Pacella for FERC. Let me say first that Sacramento did not raise this greater risk argument either on rehearing to the commission or in its initial brief, and that's why neither the commission nor I addressed it in my brief. But regardless of that, let me give you FERC's answer to that, what the commission did say and what was presented to it. FERC already decided in the Order 681 rulemaking that in response to Sacramento, that regional transmission organizations are not required to provide marginal loss hedges. The commission also said the ability to hedge all costs is not a prerequisite for just and reasonable rates. And there was a rate proposed here, and the commission found that it was just and reasonable without a marginal loss hedge. The commission also said that while theoretically possible, to date there is no marginal loss hedge and no transmission organization therefore has one. But the commission, you know, said that would be great. It's nice to hedge all costs, not necessary, but it's nice. So if you can create one, please do and propose it to us, and we'll review it and approve it if it's just and reasonable. Additionally, the commission said that physical firm transmission rights provided under the pro forma 890 tariff are not superior to California ISO's proposal, that it found that, in fact, the commission, the proposal's total package of locational marginal pricing and congestion revenue rights is superior to the physical rights scheme in 890. And that's at the third market redesign order, JA3139, paragraph 246. And again,
how is it superior? I mean, that's a conclusory statement. That's not sufficient to.
Yeah, the commission explained, Your Honor, again in the third market redesign order, paragraph 246 at JA3139, that locational marginal pricing will result in more efficient least cost dispatch and signal where investment is needed in generation and/or transmission. This efficiency, combined with long-term congestion revenue rights, will help provide increased certainty regarding the congestion cost risks of long-term transmission
How
service.
How common is it for FERC to require hedges? You said that they've ruled in the past that it's not necessary to always.
The reason a congestion hedge is required here is because of EPAC 2005. Congress said that you have to have long-term transmission rights, and the commission has interpreted that to mean that there has to be a congestion hedge. There's no statutory requirement for a marginal loss hedge. There's nothing requiring that. And so that's one of the differences that the commission explained exists here.
As I understood Mr. Ryder, I thought that he was saying that a marginal loss hedge would serve the same purpose as the congestion hedge, and that's why SMUD is arguing that there has to be one.
Their argument that a hedge is required is based on two things they pointed out in their brief. 890's requirement that deviations from the 890 tariff have to be consistent with or superior to that tariff.
Consistent or superior.
Right. And secondarily, and there's nothing in as the intervener pointed out in its brief, there's nothing in 890 that talks about marginal losses. It just says we leave it open to you to suggest one if you want one. Whatever you want to charge for marginal losses. There's nothing mentioned about a hedge at all. But also there's just the statement, as the intervener pointed out in its brief, that do what you want with losses. It was not an 890 issue. There's no specific requirement about that. And the other thing that they rely on is Order 681 statement that a congestion hedge is required to meet the consistent with the superior standard. But they're different. Marginal losses are different than congestion.
The marginal losses methodology has been employed, right, in several other New York, New Jersey, right?
That's right, in all the other ISOs, Your Honor.
How do you respond to your opponent's argument about MISO, that you feel to distinguish MISO?
You know, as we acknowledged, the commission did not specifically mention that case, but it did answer all of the underlying matters raised regarding that case. In Midwest ISO, let me say first that what was proposed was to have a transitional refund methodology where the difference between your marginal losses and average losses would be refunded to you. And that would be for a five-year period for existing members and for a one-year period for new members. Here, the proposal was that until a marginal loss hedge could be created and put into place, that which Sacramento itself said they're inherently unhedgeable at in their protest at JA 1165, for example, that there should be average losses. That is not a transitional mechanism. That's a mechanism that could be in place forever, and obviously that then wouldn't be marginal losses. It wouldn't be marginal losses. It would be average losses, defeating the purpose of having marginal losses.
I'm a little confused about one issue. Are the marginal losses hedgeable or not?
The commission found at this point that they are not.
At this point, there is
no existing hedge, right? And it hopes they're in the experimental stage, is what the commission explained. Different entities are trying to develop.
So people are trying to develop them.
Okay. That's right, and the commission is encouraging that.
Mm-hmm.
But no one here proposed any marginal loss hedge. No, none of the
parties. Then why wouldn't the MISO transition work? Because there's a possibility that you can never come up with a hedge?
You can never come up with it. That's right. But what the commission did do, there is a transitional mechanism here, the load aggregation point pricing, which we'll get into later, that for the first 3 years of the of the market that there will be load aggregation point pricing for load, which in effect is average zonal pricing. And so there is, you know, the commission's not saying we don't care about entities and we're just going to put this in, even though, you know, this is a new thing to them. The commission did put in a transitional mechanism that it found would work for the first 3 years, and then you have to make more zones and then move on to actual marginal loss pricing for everybody.
Just one more thing, so I hope I can understand this. If customers were under the pro forma tariff, they would pay average losses. Is that correct?
No, we don't know what they would pay under the pro forma tariff.
It
leaves it
something?
Completely open. They would pay whatever the transmission provider proposed and the commission approved as just and reasonable. So they could propose average losses, and if the commission found that to be just and reasonable, then they would pay average losses. If they proposed marginal losses, but there's nothing mentioned.
So this might not be a deviation at all.
It isn't a deviation. That's exactly the point. That's right, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honor. Kenneth Jaffe on behalf of the California ISO. I'd just like to address one additional point. The evidence that Sacramento claims the commission ignored concerning the riskiness of marginal losses is, in fact, much more equivocal than they represent. If you look at the evidence that they point to, which is on page 1213 of the joint appendix, what it says is that Sacramento's consultant does not know whether congestion costs or marginal losses are more volatile. He thinks they're both volatile, but he doesn't know which one is more volatile, more risky. There is other evidence in the record introduced by the California ISO, which is found beginning at page 446 of the joint appendix, that looks at experience in other regions, specifically in New York, and concludes that marginal losses, in fact, are less risky. They are less volatile, and it also points to steps that people can take, customers can take, other than a hedge, which is something they can do to limit their exposure to those risks. The one point on which Sacramento's witness was unequivocal, on page 1212, is his view that marginal losses are inherently unhedgeable. He then goes further. The commission was hopeful that that might not be true, that someone might be able to develop a hedge. But Sacramento's position was that that isn't possible. They are inherently unhedgeable. So notions that this is a temporary delay that Sacramento is asking for is nothing more than wishful thinking. On this record, the commission's conclusion that the demonstrated benefits of marginal loss pricing should not be sacrificed in the hope that there might someday be a hedging mechanism for costs that are not shown to be especially risky and something that is not required by Congress was an eminently well-founded decision. Unless you have any other questions.
Thank you. Mr. Ryder?
Briefly, counsel for FERC has suggested that the issue wasn't raised in our briefs or on rehearing. That's incorrect. Our initial brief at pages 27 to 28 addressed this, as did SMUD's initial protest at Joint Appendix 1153, paragraphs 27 and 31 of the MRTU hearing order at Joint Appendix 2441 and 2443 discussed this, as did the CRR order at Joint Appendix 3131 at paragraph 227, as did SMUD's MRTU rehearing at page 2090 of the Joint Appendix, and SMUD's CRR rehearing at page 3206. Just briefly, the MISO case, what the Commission suggests that it was that it implicitly addressed it, but if you look at paragraph 100 Joint Appendix 3432, where they mention the transition mechanism, they don't discuss at all why they were rejecting it. All they say there is that marginal losses in other areas, but they don't explain or even acknowledge that they're departing from the precedent. As for the evidence,
I think we understand your argument. If you would like to start with the CRR obligation.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Can you give me one? With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve a minute of my time on this issue.
Okay.
The purpose of a congestion revenue right, or a CRR as it's been called, is to provide customers with hedges against the risk of congestion, essentially payments to offset the congestion charges they face. The commission determined that that was required in order to protect customers so that they would have a service, a long-term firm service, that was equivalent to the physical rights type service that has been traditionally available. But the sole type of hedging mechanism they chose was what they called an obligation CRR, which, as its name implies, suggests that it not only provides payments to offset the congestion, but may reverse itself and impose an obligation on the customer. SMUD had urged the commission to consider what they called an option CRR. It's also a financial instrument, and in it, there would never be any exposure to congestion charges, similar to what you would get under a physical rights service. That this was a serious proposal, I don't think the commission can dispute, because the commission itself had ordered the ISO New England to offer its customers the choice between obligation and option type instruments. But the commission's orders here simply don't address at all that option and or explain why it should be rejected. The entirety of the commission's response to SMUD's concern is at paragraph 92 of its CRR rehearing order at Joint Appendix 3428-29. They say two things. First, they say the commission has found that the financial rights in the form of obligation long-term CRRs are equivalent to physical rights, and then they have a footnote. But the footnote doesn't support, even by its terms, doesn't support what the commission has said. That what that footnote says, and each of the descriptions of the cases cited in it, say that financial rights can be equivalent to physical rights. There's no dispute about that. SMUD's option CRR is a financial right. That's the proposal we asked the commission to give people a choice to take. The second thing the commission said is not really a response to SMUD's alternative, but a rejection of it. What they say, in fact, they admit that they haven't addressed it. This is the words that the commission used. The commission has not discussed, as SMUD states, why customers should not be given the right to purchase either option or obligation CRRs. They say they haven't addressed it, and they say why? They say because the ISO's proposal utilizing obligation long-term CRRs was found to satisfy the final rule. Well, it was found in the initial order to satisfy the final rule. We sought rehearing of that, and the commission's response is not to explain why, but just simply to say, that's what we told you the first time. That's not an explanation for the commission's decision. It's just a reiteration of its conclusion. That type of response is non-substantive. It doesn't address what this court has many times said is a fundamental responsibility of an administrative agency to address the serious alternatives presented by a party and to grapple with them, one way or the other, but to address them. The failure to do that is arbitrary and capricious. That's exactly what's happened in this case. The alternative was a serious one. It's the same type of requirement that the commission itself had imposed years ago, and the commission offers no explanation why it shouldn't implement a similar proposal.
Is there an explanation they could have given that would have satisfied you?
I don't know, if Your Honor, I don't know if there would have been.
I'm really asking whether your objection is substantive or procedural here.
Well, no, it's substantive. I mean, if they had proposed some other alternative other than an option CRR without knowing what that is, it's possible that that would have been satisfactory to SMUD. No solution is going to be perfect to any party in the marketplace. The financial instruments are inherently somewhat different from physical rights, but the option instrument is available, and some ISOs allow it. And so it's certainly feasible to implement, but the commission hasn't offered any explanation why it rejected the alternative we presented here.
You wanted to reserve 1 minute.
Yes, thank you.
We've got 30 seconds.
Well, first of all, the commission did explain in some detail why obligation congestion revenue rights were sufficient. I want to start by saying this Northeast Utilities case that Mr. Ryder's talking about, if you look in the at JA 3203, you'll find the only page of the rehearing request by Sacramento, which deals with this issue, doesn't mention Northeast Utilities. And in fact, I'm not surprised because it's a 2000 case, and my understanding is that ISO does not offer options at this time. But be that as it may, the commission didn't get a chance to address it because it wasn't raised on rehearing. In Order 681, the commission discusses in some detail. In fact, no party in that proceeding, including Sacramento, even suggested option congestion revenue rights, said that obligations were more workable and would allow for more CRRs to be issued. And the commission also addressed it specifically in the third and fourth order on appeal here. The fourth order at 3429 of the Joint Appendix, the third order at 3128 of the Joint Appendix, and it also cites specific expert testimony at Joint Appendix 3129. It cites expert testimony in this proceeding from Dr. Pope, and in fact, this is undisputed expert testimony, that congestion revenue rights of an obligation nature can supply even a perfect hedge, although we're not looking for perfection, that they're risky if they're used for speculation. They should work as a hedge, it should even out, and that options congestion revenue rights are too complex to run accurate power flow tests, and that's a reason not to use them, that the commission also recognized in the rulemaking. So the only testimony, expert testimony on this at all, supports the commission, and I believe that's a substantial evidence supporting the commission's decision here. If there are no questions?
Mr. Ryder, I think there's an intervener here. Sorry. I know this is a little bit confusing here.
Your Honors, I just have one point to add on one of the points that Mr. Ryder made. The Commission's response that the ISO's proposal to use obligation-only rights was reasonable and therefore it did not have to go further was simply a statement of the law. If the public utility making a proposal submits a proposal that is just and reasonable, and as counsel for FERC explained, there was ample evidence to support the conclusion that this proposal was just and reasonable, the fact that there may be other proposals, other alternatives that might also be reasonable is of no moment. If the utility's proposal is just and reasonable and FERC so finds, that's the end of the inquiry under the statute.
Is that right? Mr. Ryder, I thought, suggested that there's an obligation to grapple with reasonable proposals. You're saying that's not the case?
Well, there is an obligation to explain why it believes that the proposal is reasonable, and FERC did that. I mean, Mr.
With respect to the options?
It did. And Mr. Soper pointed to the evidence, and on 3130 of the Joint Appendix, you'll see where FERC actually made that conclusion, that obligation CRRs can provide a hedge for transmission schedules, as long as the CRRs are not used for speculation.
Thank you.
Your Honor, with respect to FERC counsel's argument that the New England case wasn't raised on rehearing, our argument isn't that the commission departed from precedent with regard to that issue, but that the issue was a serious one that the commission was required to engage.
I think you just heard the response. How do you reply to the argument that in fact they did engage? They don't have to mention it specifically, but they gave a rationale that was sufficient to address the same concern that your proposal of options would address.
Well, what we pointed out, and I think what the commission didn't address, is that, in fact, the commission's orders themselves recognized that the proposed solution that they advanced on brief, that you simply match the schedules to your CRR allocation, wouldn't work because nobody perfectly matches your schedules to your actual CRR allocation. And in those instances, and the issue we raised on rehearing was not that it could never happen, or that even that it would be frequent, but when the schedules wouldn't match and a negative congestion charge applied, the risk could be huge. The penalty could be huge, and especially in long-term contracting, which was what the commission was trying to deal with by ordering the option and obligation instruments for long-term planning, that wouldn't be much of a fix.
Thank you, Mr. Ryder. Ms. Swanstrom?
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. For at least three major reasons, FERC erred when it authorized the California ISO to apply its new locational marginal pricing when transmission service is taken on another entity system and losses occur during the provision of that transmission service. My client, IID, has its own transmission system, and its capacity is part of that system. First of all, Your Honors, as the California ISO conceded in its brief, and we heard FERC counsel acknowledge just a few minutes ago, under FERC's open access transmission rules, it's the transmission provider that chooses the loss rate method that should be used. In this particular instance, when there are transmission ownership rights, or what the ISO calls TORs, held by another owner, the California ISO is not the transmission provider. In my client's instance, it is the transmission provider. It has its own open access transmission tariff containing rates, terms, and conditions of service, including its own loss provision. And we respectfully submit that it's my client's tariff, not the Cal ISO's tariff, that lawfully governs service on its system.
Okay. Just so I understand what's happening here, if the TOR holders engage in transmission and it involves an interface with CAISO's system, do you cause transmission losses?
To the extent any transmission losses are caused, Your Honor, I respectfully submit they're caused on our own system, on our own capacity, not on the California ISO's system when we're using TORs.
Is that a yes to Judge Brown's question?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. There is cost causation, yes, Your Honor, but on our system, not theirs.
Okay, there are losses. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, losses occur anytime transmission service is provided. That's just a matter of engineering.
Now, one of the things that I see in the record is an assertion that when that happens, and if you don't supply the energy necessary to cover that, CAISO has to make that up. Is that correct?
And Your Honor, certainly energy does have to be supplied to make up for losses. My client and its customers self-supply energy to make up for losses. In my opinion, this isn't really a reliability issue here. It's a rate issue. That's the way FERC couched it in its brief. There's no showing that my client or its customers have failed to self-supply. It's really, how do you determine the losses? What pricing methodology do you use to determine the amount and the charges for those losses that are at issue here? If any of our clients violated a reliability standard, there are other enforcement mechanisms for that. I also wanted to point out, if I could, Your Honors, that my client is a non-jurisdictional governmental entity, and it never turned control over its transmission capacity to the California ISO, and that everyone acknowledges, all the parties. It's not a participating transmission.
Isn't the issue here, when you boil it down, that there are losses being imposed on the ISO system, and someone has to pay for that?
I understand that point, but I don't think that's the accurate description, Your Honor. What happens is there are losses on our system, and losses being imposed on our system, the TOR, or transmission capacity that we own, and that's made available under our tariff. That's what I'm trying to say. So when the losses are incurred, they're incurred on our system. For liability purpose, do losses need to be made up for? Absolutely. They're self-supplied. And
aren't there losses that occur on the ISO system?
Are marginal losses on the ISO system
system?
Are they self-supplied, are you asking me, sir?
Yeah, I'm asking if there are losses that occur and how and who pays for them under your approach.
Under my approach, when TOR capacity is used, my client's own TOR capacity is used, losses do occur. That's inevitable. But the losses are self-supplied. And there's, and like I said, we have our own tariff that has a loss rate factor in it. Also, we have a joint ownership agreement with other companies that we co-own a facility with, and that has a loss provision in it as well. I also wanted to point out, if I could please, Your Honors, that when my client is using its own transmission capacity, or what the California ISO calls TORs, it is not a transmission customer of the Cal ISO. It's using its own capacity that it owns. And I think FERC acted arbitrary and capriciously in the proceeding below when it said all users of the Cal ISO grid must consistently pay these marginal loss charges using the same methodology to avoid undue discrimination among transmission customers. My client isn't a transmission customer. It would be using its own system, or its customers would be using its own system, so it's not similarly situated in that regard. And historically in the industry, when you have two autonomous transmission providers or two autonomous what are called control area operators, now balancing authorities, the approach that historically has been taken is you sit down in a room, you mutually cooperate with each other, and you try to resolve your issues. Historically, you don't just have one transmission provider imposing its rules on another independent transmission provider.
Can I, just to make sure I understand this and have it clear, there's the green brief says, although Imperial is using its own share of a line, the loss charges that it is disputing are assessed to Imperial only if it imposes costs on the ISO system by failing to self-supply. Imperial may not have joined the ISO club, but it is fair to charge it when it dines there. Is that, why don't you just respond to that and tell me why that's wrong?
Your Honor, if we did want service from them and take service from them, that would be fair. But what needs to happen is we need to sit down and negotiate a mutual agreement for that service. There's no showing in the record that there's ever been a failure to self-supply, but bottom line is what should happen between two autonomous transmission providers or control area operators, you sit down, you work it out. They don't take and impose their tariff provisions that conflict with ours on us. One of the arguments that FERC made in its brief was that it was reasonable for marginal losses to be assessed on TOR transactions only when those transactions involved injections and withdrawals at points of receipt and delivery. But, Your Honors, the way the CalISO tariff reads, these losses would be applied when we're using our own capacity. So I think it's a little bit of a red herring to imply that, don't worry, we're only going to imply these charges when you're using our system. The charges will apply when we're using our own capacity, and I point you to some more detailed information on that. When the CalISO submitted its MRTU tariff filing, it plainly announced its intent to bill for transactions on, quote, TOR systems, and that's JA219. And if you look at section 17.3.3 of its tariff, which addresses charges for, quote, use of a TOR, it states that the CalISO will base the marginal cost of losses on LMP differentials at points of receipt and points of a delivery identified in a valid TOR schedule. Well, then if you turn around and look at the definitions of points of receipt and delivery, as well as the definitions of injections and withdrawals, those aren't limited to just the California ISO's own grid. They apply to facilities throughout the control area. So they will be applying these marginal losses, not just when we use their system, but when we use our own system. So I thought that was important to point out. In fact, there's a pretty plain statement in FERC's order where they rejected an argument squarely that it was unreasonable to assess marginal losses to TOR transactions that never utilized the CalISO grid, and FERC proceeded to authorize the CalISO to apply the marginal losses based on receipt and delivery points in a TOR contract. So there's no question here that what they proposed was going beyond just use of the CalISO's own grid. It was going to the use of TORs. And that's JA3244 and 3354. Also, Your Honors, I'd respectfully submit that FERC erred and acted arbitrary and capriciously when it departed from its past precedent without reasoned explanation. There were several agency decisions as well as an arbitration decision that we argued were FERC was departing from without a reasoned explanation. And in those agency decisions and arbitration decision, essentially it was held that the CalISO could not extend its tariff or its charges
to facilities that weren't part of its grid, but instead were owned by entities that never turned control over their facilities to the CalISO. They never addressed that. And as I mentioned earlier, also, they simply equated us to a transmission customer on their system when really, when we're using our TORs, we are not.
Okay, thank you.
May I reserve my remaining time unless you have more questions?
You have 2 minutes.
Remaining. Okay.
I'm sorry, I thought you wanted to reserve it.
If that's okay.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
The commission was very clear in its orders, explicit. For example, in the second market redesign order at JA 2601, paragraph 458, that any transmission ownership rights transaction that is subject to marginal losses involve injections and withdrawals from the California ISO grid. Petitioner counsel is just wrong that there will be any marginal loss charges on their own transmission ownership rights part of the system. That
so
is just
she,
not true.
When she said the charges will apply when they're using their own capacity.
That is not true, Your Honor. And that is contrary to these orders. It's contrary to the commission's holding. The commission, again, at JA 2614, paragraph 485, said the commission is allowing California ISO to charge Imperial for services California ISO is providing under the tariff and for use of California ISO-controlled facilities. It is absolutely clear. It also cites to Michigan Electric, 115 FERC 61105, and in that case, the commission held the tariff charges were appropriate to governmental entities where they take service not only over their own facilities, but also over FERC jurisdictional facilities. There's no question that is what the holding is here. There will be no marginal loss charges under these orders for transmission over the transmission ownership right. And it's the first time I've heard in this court today, the first time I've heard this tariff argument. I've never seen anything pointing to a tariff provision explaining that sources and sinks mean something different than what the commission said that they mean, which is that the California ISO will assess marginal losses based on the marginal cost of losses at the receipt point and delivery point on California ISO's grid. Those are the commission's explicit words. This is a non-issue.
So if there is an injection or a withdrawal from CAISO's grid, that is all that could be charged.
That
it's
is
not the entire transaction.
Not the transaction, not the portion of the transaction that's on the transmission.
So if it's off the grid, there's no marginal loss charge.
No marginal loss charge. This is a non-concern. Thank you.
Like to make one additional point. FERC did not seek to subject Imperial to regulation with respect to what Imperial may charge its own customers for losses. FERC was regulating a service the ISO provides, namely managing the schedules that are submitted to it of injections and withdrawals and making sure that the losses associated with those injections in one place and withdrawals in another place are covered. That's all FERC was regulating. Whatever Imperial wants to charge its customers for losses is between Imperial and its customers, and nothing in this decision affects that. Unless you have any other questions.
I liked your dining line on page 36. I'll be using that in appellate advocacy classes for years to come.
I have to give credit to my co-counsel at the ISO for that one. We complimented him as well.
It was a good one.
It's a good line. Thank you. Ms. Swanstrom, you have 2 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to FERC counsel's argument, I do understand what FERC said in its order, but that language does not match up with the actual tariff language, Your Honors. And there's also, just think about it commonsensically. If they didn't intend to apply marginal losses to somebody else's capacity, and they were only going to apply those loss charges when somebody was using their own grid, they didn't need to take this unprecedented step of adding a brand new section in their tariff to apply these loss charges to TORs. If it was only going to apply when someone uses their grid,
They don't need extra super special provisions for TORs. You use your common provisions for anyone else who signs up for service and uses your grid. Also, with respect to Council's reliance on the Michigan Electric case, I would respectfully submit, in your honors, if you look at that case, particularly on remand, there was a very detailed record created there of, were these entities simply using their own system, or were they also actually using the Midwest ISO grid? We don't have that kind of record here. FERC hasn't proven that people are using not only their own TORs, but also the Cal ISO grid. And in that case, the annual charge was assessed to a public utility, and a public utility then passed it on to its own customers. Again, though, we are not a transmission customer of the CalISO when we're using our own capacity. If my client said, CalISO, I want service from you, I'm signing the contract, please serve me, I'll pay your charges, we don't disagree that we should pay those charges. But when we haven't requested service from them, we're using our own capacity, we don't think that they should unilaterally impose that upon us. We think there should be a mutual negotiation of an acceptable agreement between two autonomous transmission providers or controllers to resolve this issue. Thank you so much.
Ms. Dowden?
May it please the court, my name is Lisa Dowden, and I represent Petitioner City and County of San Francisco, California, and I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. San Francisco petitions this court to set aside the commission's order on a local resource adequacy program that treats San Francisco's contractual and ownership transmission rights as though they do not belong to San Francisco, and appropriates the benefits of those rights for the use of others without compensation. The case is not about reliability, a point that FERC has seemed to concede in its orders where it describes the local resource adequacy program as an accounting exercise, but about who pays what for reliability.
I thought it was about reliability in the event of a weather event, or some outage of some kind, that there was sufficient generating capacity within the load pocket.
The resource adequacy program is about reliability in the sense that it directs entities who serve load to procure enough generation to serve their loads. And San Francisco
has
done
that. More than that, isn't it? I mean, it's about procuring load within the load pocket.
Within the load pocket and from outside the load pocket. The study in which the ISO determines how much load, how much generation must be purchased within the load pocket, takes into account both. It considers the transmission available into the load pocket, which it assumes is in use, and generation available within the load pocket for determination of what has to be procured. However, as part of that consideration, it includes transmission lines into the San Francisco load pocket that are owned or contracted by San Francisco.
Certainly, but again, maybe you got to be basic with me on this. The impression I had was consistent with what I understood Judge Kavanaugh's question to be. Aren't they requiring that you plan for contingencies that would eliminate or reduce the ability to import a capacity so that you have to have it in the area itself?
They're requiring us to plan for contingencies for if there is an outage, yes. But the study assumes all the possible resources that may be used, and it doesn't attribute ours to us. If San Francisco's petition were to be granted, it would not change the outcome of the study, which considers all the resources available and essentially allocates responsibility on a pro rata share. The problem is it doesn't take into account that our lines are ours and not theirs.
But if some kind of event knocks out a transmission line, contract rights, I think the argument is, contract rights won't keep the lights on.
Well, if enough transmission lines go out, nothing is going to keep the lights on.
Well, it's a matter of degree, right? And they're trying to plan for contingencies. All of this came about as a result of the crises.
Yes. Actually, San Francisco's contract with PG&E is a full resource contract. It's backed by PG&E's resources if our lines go out. So the load is supposed to be served even in the event of a major contingency. The point being, In allocating the amount of responsibility that each entity must purchase, the ISO takes into account all the resources that exist, the transmission resources into the load pocket, and we don't get credit for ours. They don't belong to everyone else, they belong to us.
Isn't there a difference between the system resource adequacy and this idea of local resource adequacy?
Not a relevant difference, Your Honor. Both systems are dealing with the same problem, which is constrained transmission capacity. The ISO had to come up with a methodology for allocating transmission capacity on a system basis for transmission into the ISO control area because there isn't enough to go around. They had to come up with a method for how you were going to allocate it, and they did that by taking off the top the rights that other people had by contract or ownership, and then allocating the remainder to other market entities for their use in meeting the system resource program requirements. The local load pockets are the same thing. There's a certain amount of transmission into the load pocket, and during certain times of the year, it's constrained. Not everyone can have what they want. We're saying that because some of that transmission is ours, we should be given that right off the top in the same way that it was handled in the system resource program, but that's not what was done. The ISO just took all the transmission, added it all up, added in the amount of resources that needed to be procured, and divided by load without taking into account the fact that we own this, not them. The commission offered four reasons for denying San Francisco's petition. The first was that granting San Francisco's request would be unfair to those who lack contract rights. This is contrary to the position that the commission has taken throughout the ISO's history, that it is not unfair to those who do not have contracts to actually uphold and enforce existing contractual rights. The commission has not urged this interpretation before this court and appears to have dropped it, and this may be in light of the recent Supreme Court decisions in Morgan Stanley and NRG, which have emphasized the importance of enforcing contract rights as an important part of the Federal Power Act. The second reason the commission offered was that local resources must be located in load pockets, which we have touched on here. The study considers everything, transmission into the load pocket and the need for what resources must be acquired beyond that. The only difference is that, unlike the case with system resource adequacy, that transmission that San Francisco owns is not credited to us. The rights are basically divided among everyone else as though we didn't own them, and we are.
Own, it's still owned from outside the load pocket, correct?
We own transmission, approximately 100 miles of transmission from the Hetch Hetchy generating resource to the PG&E system. From the point where we interconnect with PG&E, we have an existing contract with Pacific Gas and Electric Company, which predates the ISO, and that contract is an encumbrance on the ISO's use of PG&E's facilities. In other words, the ISO is required to honor our contract. So we own or contractually control a path all the way from the resource into San Francisco and into the load pocket.
How does requiring that you have capacity within the load pocket, how does that somehow infringe upon your existing contract rights? It's just asking you to do something more. It's not asking you to do something.
Well, actually, it is requiring us to do something more because we've already bought a resource.
It is asking you to do something more, but what's wrong with that?
Because
how does that violate existing?
Built a resource.
How does that violate existing?
And a transmission line to get our resource all the way from the generating site to load.
Isn't this just a policy judgment that's been made that in addition to being able to import load, you need to be able to have some in the pocket generated?
Right, but the study result doesn't change even if we're credited with the ownership of our transmission. The amount of generation that will have to be procured would still be the same. We merely would receive credit for the fact that we've already procured generation, which they are counting in their study, when they count those transmission lines coming into the San Francisco load pocket, and they assume they're being used. But we're not getting the benefit of that investment that we have already made.
If there is an unforeseen contingency, which is what I thought this was focusing on, something happens to that transmission facility that's outside the load pocket, how do you transmit energy from outside San Francisco into that load pocket? Isn't that what this is trying to deal with?
Not really, because the resource adequacy program can't actually address that. San Francisco has a contract with PG&E, which provides that PG&E will in fact serve the load if there is a transmission contingency. So in that sense, we are fully resourced. However, the problem is, how do you allocate the benefit of transmission rights? Folks who are using the System Resource Adequacy Program are allowed to use these contractual and ownership rights coming into the ISO to provide system resource adequacy resources. They're subject to contingency the same way anything else is, but the ISO permits that to happen because basically this is their transmission, they owned it, they paid for it, and whatever arrangements they've made elsewhere also exist. We're the only ones, as far as I am aware, that are not given the credit for our own resources.
Thank you.
And I guess I'd better...
You had asked to reserve 2 minutes, and since
so
I,
it's time I stepped
I missed
out.
That. We will give you back a minute.
The resource adequacy requirements, obviously, as the commission found time and time again in these orders, relate to reliability. And what will happen here is that each local resource adequacy requirement, which is the amount of capacity that can't be met with capacity outside a load pocket due to transmission limitations, that will the commission approve the proposed requirement that local resource, therefore, approve the requirement to that local resource adequacy requirements be met by resources within the load pocket, as Your Honors have I think, understand already.
Why doesn't that affect existing contracts, then?
If
they have existing contracts for X amount of capacity, and you're now saying some portion of that capacity has to be come from within the load pocket, why doesn't that, in fact,
the commission
their
was
contracts?
The commission explained that... they can still bring that. That has nothing to do with that. They still have the right to bring that transmission in. It's completely unrelated.
They may not need it anymore. They don't need the same capacity based on the contracts that were existing, right?
That may be true, but the point is...
That doesn't run afoul of the obligation to continue?
Well, that's always going to be true, because what you have is a right to a firm transmission except for a contingency, which San Francisco's own portion of the brief says, except for a force majeure situation. That's exactly what this is. A contingency is a force majeure situation. So they don't have a right in their contract to be bringing something in a force majeure situation. So what the ISO wants to do to make sure that they have reliable service and that load is being served is to make sure that, considering what can be brought in a contingency, that that won't be counted in the local resource adequacy requirement. If you can, even under a contingency, be able to bring that in, that's fine. It's only what can't be brought in that is in the study going to be determined as the local resource adequacy requirement. So
I understand that. I think I understand the policy determination and why this direction was taken up. But I'm not clear as to why that doesn't undermine existing contracts.
There's nothing in a San Francisco, as FERC said in its brief, if San Francisco has a contract provision saying that they satisfy any local resource adequacy requirements, this will not apply to them. And they have not shown us anything in their contract. Contract is not part of the record. I've read the contract. It does not provide anything regarding local resource adequacy requirement. So there's nothing in there. And if we invited them to say it, if it's true, if they have something, the tariff is trumped. The commission was clear about that throughout the entire set of orders here. If you have something in your contract that is different than the tariff, your contract is what works. So it's just not right. But let me say, what San Francisco's focus on today is all about the system versus local resource adequacy stuff. None of that was raised to the commission on rehearing. And you can look there, through their very short rehearing request at JA 2081 to 2085H. This has never been raised to the commission. So what I can tell you is, again, so the commission has never heard this. This study doesn't count it towards us. It's just not true. If you, even with the contingency, can bring you can bring your generation in to the load pocket, you get to use that. That counts because it's not part of a local resource adequacy requirement. So there really is no concern here about at all affecting their contract. That just definitively would not happen. But let me just spend a minute talking about the difference between system and local resource adequacy. If San Francisco were right that the system were also constrained, then it would be a local resource, it would be a load pocket. The study is going to be done every year, and ISO is going to look at where you can't serve load if there's a contingency, whatever contingency ends up being set. I don't know that that's been decided yet. And if it turns out that the entire system can't be served, then these local resource adequacy requirements would apply there as well. But definitionally, the system is different. And that's only true as long as it's factually true.
The question's what is a load pocket?
Exactly. That's right, Your Honor. That's exactly the question. But again, none of this was raised to the commission on rehearing and therefore isn't appropriately before this court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I think I have two additional points to raise since FERC counsel covered them quite well. First, I think it's important to recognize we are not allocating the benefits of the transmission system or rights to use the transmission system. What we are doing, what the ISO is doing in the local the local capacity requirement program is dealing with the problem when the transmission system is inadequate because of a contingency, because a tree fell on the line, or there's a forest fire. Contract rights can't trump physics. That's what we're dealing with here. The other point I'd like to make is the question, the argument that this doesn't affect reliability, I respectfully suggest that San Francisco's trying to have it both ways. If their contract rights indeed were the equivalent for reliability purposes of local capacity, then it would make no sense for the ISO to require the same amount of local capacity to be there. They'd be getting too much by definition. In fact, the reason why this is only an accounting exercise is precisely because contracts cannot take the place of physical capacity when the transmission system is inadequate. That's the problem this is all addressing, and contract rights can't do anything about it. Unless you have any other questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. The study was addressed before the commission. The ISO admitted that in its testimony filed with the commission and noted in our brief that when it allocates that the transmission owned by San Francisco is not specifically attributed to it. The commission recognized in its order that the ISO had represented that the annual technical study will already take into account any transmission capacity in a local capacity area before allocating the requirement. So our transmission is unquestionably in the study. It's merely not allocated to us, as is the case in the system study. The fact is that transmission constraint is transmission constraint, whether it's on a system or a local basis. If it's possible to give parties their transmission rights to recognize their existing contracts, in the system sense, there's no reason it can't be done on the local sense. And I believe that concludes my remarks, unless there are any further questions.
Thank you. Okay, Ms. Corin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. I'm Carolyn Corwin, representing San Diego Gas and Electric Company, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. San Diego's appeal involves the ISO's Congestion Revenue Rights Allocation Scheme. These are the CRRs that Mr. Ryder talked about earlier. As approved by FERC, the CRR scheme fails to take account of San Diego's unique circumstances, placing it at a serious disadvantage. As Mr. Ryder mentioned before, the point of allocating CRRs is to allow load-serving entities like SDG&E, which has an obligation to serve its customers, to hedge the congestion costs that are now part of the cost of electricity in California. This is an important financial protection that affects what customers must pay for electricity now. The CRR scheme, as it was approved, leaves San Diego largely unable to hedge congestion costs on the one line on which it critically depends for bringing in power to the San Diego area. Our argument is largely about the facts of San Diego's circumstances. The fundamental assumption on which the CRR scheme is based does not fit San Diego's circumstances. There were feasible ways to mitigate this problem without upsetting the overall CRR scheme, but FERC failed to provide an effective remedy or even to address San Diego's unique circumstances.
So you're not challenging the date of the historical reference period?
We are challenging the fact that the date combined with the way the scheme works leaves San Diego without the hedges that it needs, without the protection.
You're not saying a different time period would have solved the problem. You're saying any time period that would have been selected would have left San Diego still in a fix because of the unique circumstances?
Well, that's not quite true, although I think in reality, practically it is. There was a long period in which the arrangements for power in California for San Diego and some of the other utilities were not consistent with the historical pattern or the future needs. So practically speaking, probably any number of years would have been unrepresentative in the way that we're concerned with.
Was this just the worst one? Was 2006 particularly bad for you? Or
I don't know that it was particularly bad. I think there was a whole series of years in the mid-2000s that were uncharacteristic. And let me explain a little bit more.
Maybe I'm not understanding then. Are you rejecting the idea of a historical reference altogether? Or you don't like this one, is there a better one?
Your Honor, I guess there would have been a better one for San Diego if you go back quite a long ways or if you go several years into the future. Mm-hmm. But as a general matter, we're not saying that's a wrong way to go about it. It is something that makes some sense. The difficulty is the assumption is that the historical reference period that is chosen is one that's reasonably representative of both history and future needs. And that's what simply was not the case with San Diego for 2006.
When was? What would have been a good time?
If you had to go back and say, all right, when should we look at historically to match what we need for the future, I guess you would have to go back to approximately 1996 or 97. What happened then is that the California ISO came into existence. Then we had the California electricity crisis. Then the contracts for power that San Diego would have relied on had it been able to go into contracts itself, those got routed through the California Department of Water Resources, then reallocated for the individual utilities to manage in a way that did not match the historical usage. This is a line, and let me explain a little more. The line we're talking about, the Southwest Power Link, is one that is really a critical lifeline for San Diego. San Diego is located in the southwestern corner of California. It's in a little cul-de-sac of California. It's got limited resources in terms of siting power plants. It has Mexico directly to the south, the ocean to the west, LA directly to the north. San Diego has limited options, unlike the other investor-owned utilities in California, which are very large in area, have a lot of opportunities to put power plants, have a lot of high-voltage transmission lines that reach outside of their territories to get to other sources of power. contrast that with San Diego, which has very few alternatives. It's small. It doesn't have much room. It doesn't have many options to get out to other parts of the country, to other parts of the Western grid. We put in a couple of schematics. At the end of the opening CRR brief, there are a couple of schematics that show you the contrast between the other utilities, which have lots of lines extending from them, lots of high voltage lines, so that they can get to a lot of different resources. They have lots of different options. San Diego, in contrast, has very few ways to get outside of its service territory to access power. Yet San Diego has a service obligation to over 3 million customers. In order to try to give its customers access to more sources, San Diego in the 1980s built this line called the Southwest Power Link to allow it to access the lower cost power from the east for its customers. This is a line called SWPL. As I said, it's the lifeline for San Diego. It's what San Diego needs in order to cover a large percentage of its needs. Before the ISO was in existence, SWPL carried approximately 30% of San Diego's needs. Today, the need is even greater, and that is because the California Public Utilities Commission has imposed a requirement for renewable sources of power. As of this year, 2010, all the utilities in California have to produce 20% of their power that they use for their customers from renewable resources.
I think your argument goes a lot to what our role is here, because you're making good arguments for carving out San Diego, but the commission said, no, we're going to stick with this approach. And anytime you have a rule that applies to different parties, some are going to be harmed more than others, some are going to be benefited more than others. But is it our role necessarily to upset that choice of a line, and on what basis would we do so?
Your Honor, if it were a question of simply a matter of degree, if San Diego were able to access a number of CRRs but not as many as it wanted and said, gee, I'd like 5% or 10% more, or I'm not quite as well off as my neighbor to the north, Southern California Edison, that would be a closer, tougher question, because I think their issues of discretion and deference probably do come in. This is a situation in which, because of the historical circumstances and San Diego's geographical circumstances and limited options, San Diego ends up with a very, very tiny fraction of what it needs. It is a matter of really not getting what this whole scheme is intended to provide. San Diego ends up without significant ability to hedge those congestion costs.
The argument is San Diego is so different that it's outside the zone of reasonableness to not to carve out.
Yes, I think that is fair to say, and this is not a new situation. We cited some precedents to FERC, and we've cited those in our brief, where FERC, in other situations where there were markets and the ISO, for example, wanted to make a change, and that disadvantaged one particular market participant or a minority group of market participants, FERC said, we need to do something here. There needs to be some remedy. We need to make some accommodation, and therefore ordered that didn't approve it without making some accommodation, giving some relief.
Now, what about the 206 process that they cite that's available to you? I realize that's not perfect, but why doesn't that solve some of the problem, the availability of that?
Well, we don't think it does solve a problem. First, we think we have made the case under Section 205, which is, of course, a proceeding where the ISO proposing the rate has the burden of proof. We don't think that this is a just and reasonable and not unduly discriminatory proposal, and therefore we think we are entitled to the Section 205 relief. The idea that we should sit back, wait, and file a complaint is simply it's not sufficient. First, the burden of proof shifts. We would have the burden of proof under the Section 206 proceeding. Secondly, relief under Section 206 is prospective only. We would be in a position where the CRRs would already have been initially allocated. In fact, they have been already. And people would be arguing that they had vested rights, they had detrimental reliance, and so on. We think our relief has to be in the Section 205 context. Now, to go back to one of the questions earlier, our concern, of course, is with the historical reference period, but it is really a double whammy for San Diego, because the historical reference period doesn't fit San Diego because of this unusual period when the contract rights were kind of shuffled around in a way that didn't match history or geography. But then the problem is they get locked in. Under this scheme, the initial CRR holder can hold on to the CRR indefinitely, and that can be either by renewal each year of the initial CRR allocation by the entity that got it on the first go-round, or it can be by transforming that short-term CRR into a long-term CRR.
In what way do you think FERC did not take into account San Diego's unique circumstances?
I think you'll look at both the FERC initial order and rehearing order on CRR and find no reference to the unique circumstances that San Diego faced. In the initial order, there was very little discussion of San Diego's argument. In the rehearing order, there was more, but it did not encompass the arguments that I've highlighted, that San Diego is in a special circumstance of being highly dependent on this one line and not having the kinds of options that the other utilities, the other load-serving entities have.
FERC did order some modifications, correct?
FERC ordered one modification that it thought was something that would help San Diego. That is not the case. They ordered a limitation on the number of short-term CRRs that could be transformed into long-term CRRs.
From 50 to 20% or something like that, wasn't it?
Yes. It was originally proposed to be 50% of load, and it was reduced to 20%.
Seems pretty significant.
It's significant if that were the only way you could hang on to a CRR, but it
was based on San Diego's unique circumstances, though, wasn't it?
No, it was not at all. It was a change that was supposed to provide more flexibility for everybody. The problem is that the way you can hang on to a CRR is not only to make it a long-term CRR, but to just keep renewing each year your short-term CRR. That is what we think would happen with these SWPL CRRs. They're very valuable. They're something that others will want to keep, to hang on to, and they have the ability to do so under this scheme. So we think that it's a violation of the statute because there's an obligation on FERC to provide that rates are just and reasonable and not unduly discriminatory. Here, San Diego is in special circumstances, has not gotten this ability to hedge, and we think that's not just and reasonable, reinforced by the 2005 change that talked about long-term rights being for planned power arrangements, arbitrary and capricious because FERC did not recognize, did not address SDG&E's individual circumstances, and this entirely undermines the purpose of the CRR scheme for San Diego. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Corwin.
May it please the Court. Well, I think the key point is that the Commission did indeed address San Diego's claim that it was unique. And in the fourth order at JA 3407.
The complaint here is not really that it was not addressed. The complaint is it wasn't addressed sufficiently.
Well, what the Commission said was San Diego had not, based on what it presented, shown that it had unique circumstances that rendered the congestion revenue rights allocation program and the historic period unjust and unreasonable, and it was not unduly discriminatory. The rationale, and it was interesting to hear Ms. Corwin say some of the things she's talking about. She says, well, it was not uncharacteristic for all the load-serving entities. In fact, the things that San Diego cited, that it was an anomalous time because it was after the 2000 crisis and they had special power acquisition requirements based on the state of California's laws, that applied to all the utilities involved, not just San Diego. So what the Commission said was, you haven't presented a record that shows us that there is undue discrimination here. And also, I mean, at this point, it's kind of a moving target.
I thought part of the argument was there's some unique physical characteristics as well, well that limited San Diego that wouldn't limit others.
Yeah, well, San Diego is unique in that it's San Diego. It has fewer resources, but The other load-serving entities have much larger loads. They have more sources, but they have much larger loads. I mean, these are all, they're all unique in that sense. We didn't create, you know, the borders of San Diego. The commission just has to deal with, you know, what the situation is in California. And we found...
Are you saying that San Diego is not qualitatively different enough, or just that they didn't make enough of a record about their uniqueness?
They didn't make enough of a record at this. First of all, I want to emphasize the commission said at this time. The commission said, mentioned the 206 remedy. It said this is an ongoing process, and it said you have not shown, based on what you presented so far, at this time, we're dealing with a rate-making situation here, where we're balancing, the ISO comes in with a very carefully calibrated congestion revenue rates plan that all stakeholders, or almost all stakeholders, agreed on.
How would the 206 process work in reality?
Well, it was very interesting to hear Ms. Corwin talk about it's an annual ongoing program, and so, under those circumstances, since it's an annual ongoing program, if after the first year, San Diego had believed that there was a problem, it could have come in and said, well, we want a different allocation for the next year. This is not a situation where we have to deal necessarily with retroactive matters. This is an ongoing program. The long-term rights are only tied up 20% the first year because of the adjustment the commission made. So this is actually a situation where 206 would, in my opinion, work quite well.
How quickly does the 206 process move?
Well, it has to move with some dispatch because there are time limits built into it. Once it's filed, there is a refund effective date, so there is protection.
Okay. Yeah.
Again, the commission, this is a rate-making matter. Historical periods are a traditional rate-making tool. The commission explained you didn't want something too close to the actual period when the matters were occurring, because there could be, people could perhaps speculate about their realign their contracts. You didn't want it so far back, certainly not in 1999, when it was not reasonably representative. So, typical rate-making situation, this is the kind of thing the commission does all the time, and it certainly deserves the court's deference in drawing rate-making lines in this situation. We do, again, have expert testimony here by Dr. Christoph, at 2794 of the Joint Appendix and 2783, that for one thing, the argument that San Diego made that, well, the big guys are going to come in and gobble up what we want and sell them to us down the line as a speculation. The system of congestion revenue rights has built in anti-hoarding devices because you would risk a lot if you speculate. Pacific Gas and Electric and Edison, in fact, the first year, like San Diego, had to have show historical usage. So they couldn't just come in and get things that they didn't, you know, some deserve. That's just not the situation. So I think then, you know, the bottom line is this is a reasonable rate-making situation. San Diego did not present enough evidence, or any evidence really, that it was unique. And the commission said, look, we have this carefully calibrated system. At this time, you have not shown us that there is any reason that this is unjust and unreasonable. Yes, you might not get all the CRRs you want, but as you pointed out, Judge Kavanaugh, in rate making, there are always winners and losers. If there are no further questions.
Thank you.
I would just like to touch on two matters in the time available. First, I want to remind the court, because it seems to have gotten lost perhaps in this morning's argument, the aspect of the CRR program that San Diego challenged was the selection of 2006 as the historic reference period. And while indeed San Diego is San Diego, San Diego was San Diego in 2006. It didn't suddenly stop being San Diego in 2007 or become San Diego.
But I think their point is that for any date in the recent past that's selected as the historical reference period, there's going to be a problem applying it to San Diego.
Indeed, Your Honor, but San Diego's complaint to FERC was that 2006 was a year when it was abnormal, and it did not support that point. I think the other thing I'd like to address is the Section 206 remedy. As Ms. Corwin pointed out, one of the alternatives that San Diego proposed hinged on an aspect of the program, the CRR program, called the priority renomination process. That is an annual process where every year a holder of a seasonal one-year congestion revenue right has the opportunity to renew that right for an additional year. And that was one of the elements of the program through which the ISO sought to balance considerations of both flexibility and certainty. Utilities need both. They need the ability to modify their CRR holdings as their power supply requirements change, but they also need the ability to hold on to them so that when they make long-term commitments, they can match them. Part of San Diego's complaint was that FERC did not modify the priority renomination process to put a limit on how many times a CRR could be renewed. But what that means is that 206 would be a very apt remedy, because if San Diego makes its case, if it substantiates its claim that not only was it not allocated enough CRRs, but it cannot obtain them on reasonable terms through the other mechanisms, and if it prevails, it would be very easy for FERC to adjust the priority renomination process on a prospective basis and grant complete relief. And Judge Kavanaugh, I would also point out, FERC actually acts quite quickly under the Section 206 process. The statute provides that the relief applies as of the date the complaint is filed. And moreover, FERC has a provision for something called the fast-track process to process complaints very quickly. And I can tell you from personal experience that they do that without much consideration for the schedules or personal lives of practitioners. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Jaffe. Ms. Corwin, we used up your time, but we'll give you back a minute.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. I'd like to briefly respond to Mr. Jaffe's points. He may have forgotten that the staff of the CAISO itself recognized that San Diego had a serious problem here. In a memo to the Board of Governors, the staff of the CAISO said, "We think that San Diego needs a remedy here." Certainty and flexibility are the two factors that Mr. Jaffe mentioned. San Diego ends up with neither of those. It has neither the certainty of an allocation nor the flexibility because it never got an allocation in the first place. Section 206 is a nice idea, and we certainly would welcome it if it turns out that it does work, but it is not a remedy that allows you to get in at the ground floor. You're always coming in after the fact and saying, well, now we're out of luck because Edison or PG&E didn't give up their SWPL CRRs.
Something, right? But it's just not enough.
It's something, but if we could be assured that Edison and PG&E wouldn't come in and say, we've detrimentally relied on getting those SWPL CRRs, we can't give them up now, I think there are going to be some serious legal and factual issues down the road. Okay. I would also point out that Dr. Kristoff, who was cited as the declarant for the ISO, did acknowledge that the alternative of cutting off a sunset provision for some of these CRRs where the underlying contract is expiring was feasible, and the ISO itself did say so as well in its answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Council.